morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We're ready tomorrow to sit down and talk, but we can't sit when the army and the police continue to kill our people. We cannot do that. Was it undermining and sacrificing the lives of our people for nothing? That cannot be.
Eswatini groups unanimously reject Sibaya, a national public meeting, as a platform for meaningful dialogue to ease the political unrest in the kingdom.
If the U.S. government is interested in protecting business, the best thing you can do in Equatorial Guinea is really to ensure that there is rule of law. And if the U.S. government, the Biden administration, as it has stated from the beginning, cares about human rights and democracy in Africa, Equatorial Guinea is a place that is desperate for democracy, is desperate for human rights.
A civil society group calls on the international community and the government of Spain to withdraw support for the administration in Equatorial Guinea.
I cannot be intimidated from expressing my displeasure on the manner in which security is trying to say they have investigated the priest is guilty. It's nonsense.
And the minority leader in the Ugandan parliament says it is unacceptable for the police to use its powers to undermine the constitution. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Uganda police say a bomb blast left at least one person dead and several others injured in the capital Kampala Saturday. The police have since launched an investigation into what some security analysts say could be a terrorist attack. Reacting to the incident, President Yoweri Museveni said the blast was a terrorist attack. He called on Ugandans not to be afraid, adding that his administration is undeterred in its determination to defeat the terrorist. For more reaction, I reach Mathias Rukundo, president of the Uganda Journalists Association.
It is one of those incidents that worry us most, not as just as journalists, but also as part of the bigger community of Uganda, that such incidents happen so often and put most of us in fear, but we are hopeful. To just give you a picture of what really I have gathered as an individual and a leader in communities, that the incident took place at a place called Koma Mboga, just after Imperial, some place called Imperial, not far from the place where I stay. So I think it was a mistake that these gatherings have been allowed in places where they're not even supposed to happen. I'm thinking there could be issues between individuals competing, you know, African beliefs of competing. They're not that. They have different approaches when they want to out-compete their friends. Because just a few meters from where that incident took place, there was another place called Mukaga, where similar activities were going on and people were earning a lot of money. So I have a feeling, and yet to establish whether it is a fact, that for those that have talked to you, they suggest that it could be issues of competition in business and sort of that.
Are the police saying there's an investigation about circumstances leading to this bomb blast?
I think 1 hour back, I have used that same road and the place has been cordoned off, and I think the investigations are going on. The road that leads to that place actually has been closed, and I have to believe that the police is already investigating. So far, I've heard the president saying he's also interested. He has made a comment, I think, highlighting that he wants to establish whether it's a foreign attack or a local or an internal issue. So police is investigating. We've contacted them. They're surely saying they're going to be revealing the circumstances under which this happened. So we will be waiting to hear from them later in the day on the confirmations of what findings they've made so far.
But Matthias, there is mixed information about the number of people who were injured or dead. What are the police saying about victims of this blast?
I have been largely informed that they confirmed death of one person and about seven had gotten injured in the incident. And the owner of the place and told he was also admitted in the hospital. But all the issues, all those allegations are yet to be established conclusively.
Matthias, some people are describing this as a terrorist attack. In fact, President Museveni said it's a terrorist attack. Ugandans should not be afraid and that his government is determined to defeat this terrorist or this attack or those responsible for this attack. I understand the UK embassy also warned of a possible attack. and people were worried why nothing was done. What can you tell me about how people are reacting to this?
People are worried. People are scared, but I believe there must be lines of hope because everyone is asking, okay, fine. To start with, why would you allow such a gathering to take place and continue going on? Why the requirements in the guidelines of COVID do not allow them to work? So for also police to just allow that go on in their vicinity, because it's just near where the police station is. So everyone is asking, why would police allow? Well, I, as an individual, I am yet really to believe that it was an attempt by a foreign effort, maybe call it terrorist. I still believe there is more that we need to find out. Because I have been told, like I told you earlier, that there were issues of business from a neighbor on the other end saying, no, we can't allow it to go on as we've been stopped working. So there's a lot that the government actually and security agencies should focus on than taking it as an obvious attack from the terrorists. But people are worried, and I want to believe that security agencies will take their responsibility and try to do much more than what they are doing.
Matthias Rukundo is the president of the Uganda Journalists Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The minority leader in the Ugandan parliament says it is unacceptable for the police to use its powers to undermine the constitution. Attorney Matthias Mpuuga says it appears the police use intimidation and harassment tactics to target critics of the government who express concern about the economic and human rights situation in the country. His remarks come after police indicted a Catholic cleric, a critic of the government, with murder charges. Police accused Father Richard Mugisha of having a hand in the death of a man who died in custody. The cleric and an accomplice are accused of beating up the man who reports say broke into the parish and attempted to steal from Father Mugisha. The man subsequently died from his injuries hours later in police custody. Police spokesperson Fred Enanga denied the allegation that critics of the government are being targeted. He says that the police are investigating the death, adding that those responsible will face the full force of the law. But parliamentarian Matthias Mpuuga tells me the accusations and charges against the cleric are trumped up to silence him from criticizing the government.
Suddenly, I have expressed my displeasure in the manner in which the state has chosen to go the shortcut in addressing criminality in the country, an approach that I believe cannot solve the ongoing and nascent criminality levels in the country. The fact that the state has chosen, instead of investigating, but instead choose to indict the priest, who is a known critic of the regime, and especially on abuse of human rights. And you see, you can never distinguish between what the people know and see from how you undertake criminal justice system, because the system is about the people and how the people feel. So alienating processes from the people actually makes the entire criminal justice system a farce. The people in Masaka know so well that the good young priest never killed anyone.
The police denied allegations of trying to frame the priest. Fred Enanga said detectives are just investigating a murder offense and therefore those found culpable would have to answer in the court of law. Isn't it the right procedure? So why are you against this?
Mr. Enanga, with due respect, was just playing a template, and I'm very sure he doesn't know what he's talking about. Assuming that they're investigating, so do you indict and then investigate? What do you first? So it's really doing work upside down. So I am most reluctant responding on a templated Mr. Enanga.
He argued that any decision that would come out of the ongoing investigation would be based on fact and not politics.
But certainly they have already gone political by failing to respond to a complaint, because the priest is a complainant. And responding and investigating his complaint, they instead accused him of murder. And actually, that same police station, in a single week, three citizens have died in their custody. And Enanga is here to tell us who killed these people at a police station. So for some of us who follow these people every day, we actually feel ashamed of even having to respond to them, because they're a shameful lot.
Some of your critics are saying, as a minority leader in parliament, it is unfortunate that you will throw your support behind somebody who faces a serious charge, such as an attempted murder or murder? How do you respond to that?
First of all, the priest is not guilty of an offense. So I'm within right to defend, one, the sanctity of his profession as a priest, the priest of the whole, or the whole Catholic Church, not because I'm Catholic, but because I'm also alive to the situation in the region and why the police chose a shortcut. I can tell you, Peter, you call me after all is said and done, and I'll tell you the state will apologize to the church for choosing a shortcut instead of investigating a complaint by the priest who was attacked. Probably it renders credence to suspicion that this person was set up. So if, again, at the end of the day, they think the priest is guilty before even an investigation report is produced, so what more can I listen to them? At least as a lawyer, I know for a fact that this gentleman is not guilty because no investigation has pinned into any matter. It's just a wild accusation by an entity unable to investigate, but choosing a shortcut to appease the powers that be.
Are you going to rally support for the priest, his legal team? What's next for you in your support for this priest?
I have made my statement and I have made my position very clear. I'm very sure that the church has the competence to assign an attorney onto the priest. I have offered my moral support, but also challenge the police to expedite their investigations. First of all, to investigate the circumstances under which this person was so killed, said to be killed, how he ended up in the priest's compound, which is a fence with a gate, how he ended up in the priest's car, how he ended up trying to attempt to drive it out of the priest's compound, unknown to the priest at all. These are the questions for which we seek answers, and I cannot be intimidated from expressing my displeasure on the manner in which security is trying to say they have investigated the priest is guilty. It's nonsense.
Mathias Mpuuga is the minority leader in the Ugandan parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Eswatini, political parties and civil society groups have unanimously rejected Sibaya, a national public meeting, as a platform for meaningful dialogue to ease the political unrest in the kingdom. Under the umbrella group called the Swaziland Multi-Stakeholders Forum, the groups rejected the king's call as unacceptable. Sibaya is the annual general meeting in Eswatini that allows the presentation of controversial and pressing views in the kingdom. Representatives from the Swaziland Multi-Stakeholders Forum who met in Manzini Saturday say King Nswati's call for dialogue using Sibaya as a platform is a ploy to mislead envoys from countries in the region. The envoys from the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, recently met with all stakeholders in an effort to ease the political tensions in the country. The envoys in a communique called for a national dialogue. This, after meeting the king, his government, and others, including civil society groups and an umbrella group, the Political Parties Assembly, or PPA. Attorney Thulani Rudolf Maseko is the chairperson for the Swaziland Multi-Stakeholders Forum. He tells me that members of the group have resolved to escalate the political crisis in the country to ensure a genuine solution that will lead to political and democratic reforms.
Yes, Twitter, the Multi-Stakeholder Forum rejects with the contempt it deserves the attempt by the king to subject the dialogue, the negotiating process to the Sibaya. As we have mentioned this afternoon, we have over the years mentioned that we don't consider Sibaya to be a conducive forum for effective, meaningful, genuine, committed process of engagement, for the reason that, first of all, we don't get involved in the crafting of the agenda for the meeting. Thirdly, we have no control on the implementation of the decision. But fundamentally, Sibaya is not a forum where we can express ourselves as freely as we would want to. It is a forum where we don't go there on an equal footing as those who are supporting current regime.
Under what conditions will you engage in a dialogue with the powers that be, the king perhaps, and his government, to resolve this political unrest in Eswatini?
I think we also need to be clear, Peter, that when we are saying we are calling for a dialogue, we are not hoping that the king himself would sit at the meeting. He may sit at the meeting if he wants, but this dialogue is supposed to be a dialogue with the government. And as we understand it, the king is supposed to delegate his government through the prime minister to sit down with us and engage on what we call talk about talk, on how we see the process unfolding. If he's committed to a process of dialogue, we should just declare that henceforth he has commissioned his government to engage with the people who have been calling for change over the years.
So under what conditions will the multi-stakeholders forum in Eswatini agree for a dialogue that you see the objective of the demand for political reforms or democratic reforms in Eswatini?
I'm saying, Peter, just yesterday, we had a meeting with the special envoy which came to the country on the advice of His Excellency Ramaphosa to come and meet, first of all, with the king, and therefore they met with us. And we said to the special envoy, Radebe, that we see this process unfolding in a manner that first and foremost, we must commit to an all-inclusive, you know, a process where all parties have a stake in the engagement. And, you know, a process should be underpinned by an environment, of course, we agree with the government, an environment that is conducive to engagement. But right now, we've got the army and the police shooting people, killing people, breaking people's bones, maiming, torturing and harassing communities. It cannot be that the king wants to start a process without us having overcome how the army and the police should return to the barracks to ensure that the environment is conducive for a negotiation.
So, Thulani, where do you go from here after rejecting Sibaya as a platform for a genuine dialogue? Where do you go from here? How do you resolve the ongoing unrest in Eswatini, particularly when the government has banned all forms of protest?
Look, the problem is that we have a government that on the one hand says we, the people, must comply with the laws of the country. On the other hand, they are the ones who on a daily basis, you know, violate the law with patent contempt. The question is simple. What power do they have to ban people protesting in the face of the constitution? Now, they are saying that you must dial down the tension that exists in the country. Ours, we are going to dial up the country. We are going to ensure that the country is as ungovernable as possible to ensure that the process of dialogue is started earnestly, not waiting for October next year when the king decided to come out of the Ingwala ceremony has made us move.
But Thulani, if the crisis is escalated, as you said, doesn't that threaten the country's peace and stability?
As you speak, there's no peace and stability, Peter. As you speak, people are being tortured. So it is upon them to decide to ensure that the environment is conducive for dialogue. We are ready. We are ready tomorrow to sit down and talk. But we can't sit when the army and the police continue to kill our people. We cannot do that. We'll be undermining and sacrificing the lives of our people for nothing. That cannot be.
Attorney Thulani Rudolph Maseko is the chairperson for the Swaziland Multi-Stakeholders Forum. He spoke with me from Manzini in Eswatini. The executive director of Equatorial Guinea Justice, a civil society group, is calling on the international community and the government of Spain to withdraw support for the administration in Malabo. Tutu Alicante says the international community should also hold accountable those responsible for the gross violations of human rights following an independent and transparent investigation. His remarks come after reports that a White House delegation will meet the authorities in Equatorial Guinea this week. The focus of the meeting, the report says, will be on maritime security in the Gulf of Guinea. Mr. Alicante says the White House delegation should also pressure the administration there to allow civil society and opposition groups to freely operate. But supporters of the government reject his call. They argue that it is unpatriotic and an invitation to foreign interference in a sovereign country's internal affairs. Tutu Alicante, however, tells me that in dealing with the government in Equatorial Guinea, President Joe Biden's administration should demand respect for the rule of law, human rights, and the fight against corruption.
So here you have a government that's been there for 5 decades, and during those
50 years, 53 years to be exact, this country have become synonym of human rights violations, of corruption, of impunity, right? And that has been thanks in part to the support of the international community, primarily Spain, which is the country that knows Equatorial Guinea best, and the U.S., because most of the businesses in Equatorial Guinea today are U.S. companies, U.S. oil companies, right? So it is critical that these two countries withdraw their tacit or otherwise support for the government of Equatorial Guinea. It is critical that they push this government to actually democratize, to actually allow political opposition and civil society organizations to do the work that, you know, has to be done to raise consciousness among people.
A delegation from the White House report suggests we'll be going to Equatorial Guinea for maritime security in the Gulf of Guinea. What are your expectations of this anticipated meeting with government officials in Equatorial Guinea?
It is surprising to many of us that during that same visit, that delegation will be visiting Nigeria. And Nigeria, as most of us know, has had several presidents since Theodore Obiang has been in power. Yet in Nigeria, they'll be discussing, among other things, human rights and democracy. Why is it that in Equatorial Guinea, maritime security, which I understand the importance of ensuring the pirates are not attacking the oil companies there, but why is it that that takes precedence over human rights, over democracy, over rule of law? And that's what we think should change.
But what do you say to those who are of the opinion that those who are civil rights activists and organizations in Equatorial Guinea and human rights defenders and who obey the laws governing these operations are free to operate without any hindrances, and that those who are clamoring and calling for sanctions and support to be withdrawn are those who are trying to destabilize the West African country?
Yeah, that's precisely the argument the president of Young Max, right? On the other hand, we have the examples of people like Alfredo Kenve, a friend of mine who is now in exile in Spain. Ramon Esono Balé, an artist who was in prison for 6 months, who is now in exile in Salvador. Joaquin Eloy Yeto, and I can go on and on. All these people, they've been in prison, they've been tortured by this regime because of their promotion of human rights. You know, so the evidence of this government squashing any sort of human rights advocacy, any sort of pro-democracy efforts is clear and present.
But what do you say to critics who are of the view calling for the removal of support for the administration is basically inviting foreign interference into the domestic political structure? And by so doing, you are trying to undermine the social fabric and disturb the country's territorial integrity, which they think can be treasonous.
The government of Equatorial Guinea on its own accord have signed into international documents, international treaties, international covenants that obligate that government to respect human rights. This is a voluntary action that the government has taken. Commission, African Union, and signing covenants to promote democracy, to allow rule of law, right? When you take these international obligations, you have to abide by them, right? You cannot go on signing documents around the world and then coming into your country and torturing people to death, right? It seems incongruent. So I don't think there is any interference in national affairs here. This is the government that internationally has undertaken to respect human rights.
What do you expect President Biden's administration's relations with Equatorial Guinea to be?
Well, we are calling on the Biden administration to shift its focus in Equatorial Guinea. So far, Equatorial Guinea has been looked as a source of oil energy. And I think it's time to go beyond that type of, in my view, limited approach to Equatorial Guinea. So if the U.S. government is interested in protecting business, the best thing it can do in Equatorial Guinea is really to ensure that there is rule of law. And if the U.S. government, the Biden administration, as it has stated from the beginning, cares about human rights and democracy in Africa, Equatorial Guinea is a place that is desperate for democracy, is desperate for human rights.
Tutu Alicante is the executive director of Equatorial Guinea Justice, a civil society group. He spoke with me from here in Washington. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, a prominent Nigerian cleric is calling on President Muhammadu Buhari and his government to reveal the names of all sponsors of terrorism in the West African country. Bishop Matthew Hassan Kuka, head of the Catholic Diocese of Sokoto, a major city in northwest Nigeria, expressed concern about the ongoing security situation in the country. He also says the rate at which citizens are losing their lives in Nigeria through a wave of kidnappings, banditry, and terrorism is unacceptable. In part two of an interview, the Catholic cleric tells me that citizens are living in fear due to the ongoing security situation. Bishop Kuka denies his criticisms are politically motivated to make the government unpopular.
For me, this is not about politics. It's about the fact that our lives are hemorrhaging by the day. And there is, I mean, Sokoto, where I live now, we just lost about 30 or so people. According to official government records, people are saying the numbers are higher. We don't know what the real numbers are. And these are innocent traders just going about their business. They didn't quarrel with anybody. And for me, there has to be an answer to these questions. For me, so it's not about being. This is the greatest criticism that government. So the greatest criticism that government has for it attracted to itself. So it's got nothing to do with what Bishop Kuka feels. It's about the realities that are on the ground. I'm not. My criticism has nothing to do with politics. I have a responsibility as a Christian, as a bishop, you know, to speak about the sanctity of life. And I would like to hear anybody from the president right now who thinks that anybody is happy with the amount of loss of lives that we are having in the country.
Bishop Kuka, you are the head of the Catholic Diocese of Sokoto. What is the current security situation in Sokoto, and what have you been hearing from residents and those parishioners who come to you about the security situation in that part of the country?
Look, you know, I mean, the truth of the matter is that it's the entire country that is literally a crime scene, let me put it that way. There's no, I mean, it is Sokoto today, it is Gusau tomorrow, it is Katsina next tomorrow, it is some town somewhere in Ibadan, it's Oshogbo, it's everywhere. So nobody just knows where, you know, which part of Nigeria will be next. The truth of the matter is that Nigeria is surrounded by literally a ring of fire. There's no place you can say this is the safest place to be. Abuja has had its own fair share of problems. So I live in Sokoto. What happened yesterday is a tragedy, but even a far more serious tragedy also occurred in Sokoto sometime last. You know, that is that innocent people just going about their business. They've got no quarrel with anybody. And suddenly people come from God knows where and simply more ordinary citizens to death. And then we just think the solution to the problem is to turn the next page. You don't have to be an angel, you know, to know and say that this is not acceptable, because the question is how much is enough. So people are living in fear.
Well, but Bishop Kuka, the government is saying that they are doing everything to protect life and property as mandated by the Constitution. The president said Nigerians should have patience as the security authorities try to bring the situation under control.
We are giving the security operatives all the support that we can. And don't get me wrong, I do commend our soldiers, all our men in uniform and women in uniform. I know that people are doing the best that they can. But for some inexplicable reason, we just don't seem to get a sense of where we are. For example, I mean, the governors are saying one after the other, they know where these bandits are. That's what everybody will tell you. People have gone to the forest and spoken to the bandits. Now, if you know where the bandits are, what is the problem? Secondly, we are now going to have elections in Anambra by the grace of God. The police are already saying they are going to send 34,000 or so thousand policemen to Anambra just to conduct an election. Now, if we have this number of policemen, if you send 5,000 or 10,000 or whatever, we deploy them to where these problems are. Shouldn't that be our immediate concern? The strategy, the tactics, whatever they are, people are dying, including you know, the security forces themselves. So our hearts go out to them. So my argument is that we are fighting a bunch of people that should not be able to pose the kind of threat that these people are posing to a legitimate government, such as the one that we have. So whether it's a failure of strategy or whether it is sabotage, I have no idea. But all I know, by whatever means, my hope and my prayer is that somehow the government will find it within itself and its powers to bring this tragedy to an end.
Bishop Matthew Hassan Kuka is the head of the Catholic Diocese of Sokoto. He spoke with me from Sokoto, a major city in northwest Nigeria. Josephine Ekiru from Kenya is the winner of the United States Institute of Peace, or USIP, Women Peace Building Award 2021. She had been shortlisted among the 10 finalists for the award. Ms. Ekiru is the peace coordinator with the Northern Rangelands Trust. She is credited with pioneering an innovative approach to peace building using environmental conservation as an entry point. The USIP Award, which coincides with the International Day of Peace, is given annually to a woman peace builder who has contributed significantly to ending conflict in her country. Officials say the winner of this year's prestigious award will be announced at a ceremony to be held on the campus of USIP on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. For reaction to being the winner of the USIP Women Peace Building Award, I read Josephine Ekiru in Isiolo County in Kenya.
I was very excited because I wasn't expecting such kind of news, because it is my first time, and in my life I never thought I could win such recognition.
So what does this mean for your work?
It means a lot for my work, because it has really energized me, motivated me so much. And I know it's going to build trust between me and the communities that I serve. And the people maybe who have been feeling me as enemy or feel me like person, because in this work, I've faced a lot of challenges because of different communities. So I believe with this recognition, this award, I know it will build trust between me and many communities. And also, it will motivate many women or inspire many women in pastoral communities or in these regions to fight for peace, to speak for peace, to come together. And I know it will inspire also individuals to come out and support peace, and also to emerge to be the leaders in this society.
So, Josephine, what inspired you or motivated you to make a decision to embark on this peace-building effort?
How I grew up is contributed a lot in what I'm doing today, because I grew up in a pastoral community that livestock keepers. I remember we had a good land, good life, full of happiness. One life for a year, the environment was good. There was no challenges of climate change as we are facing today. But suddenly things changed. I saw a lot of things that happened, struggles, crises. Until today, we are suffering because of a lot of things like conflict, destruction of environment and wildlife, and also which has led us now to suffer on issues of climate change. And when I was young, these things happened. Suddenly happened when I was there, and actually it inspired me, like something within me felt like we need to do something. Something is going wrong and we need to do something. And that's why I did everything that I did, not because of my life, because I never want my children or the new generations to face or to go through what I've gone through in my life, like looking at our communities fighting each other, destroying their own lives, environment, and everything. It was all about destruction, but not building the future of our communities or or future generations. So I did it all because I want to see future generations doing life, not causing pain to each other. I want to see them sharing good stories and causing pain to each other.
What is your message to other women trying to bring peace to their environment or peace to their respective countries?
Also, I would say that I appreciate every woman across the globe for the effort to bring peace to their own community and to the entire world. And my message today to them is that let us still keep going. This is a call, and it's not because of us, because of our future generation. And we should stand firm, no matter the challenges. We let us commit ourselves for the challenge.
Josephine Ekiru is the peace coordinator with the Northern Rangelands Trust. She spoke with me from Isiolo County, Kenya. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's start with the Women's Africa Cup of Nations Morocco 2022 qualifiers. Nigeria beat Ghana 2-0 in the first leg of their first round on Wednesday. Nigeria's Super Falcons are three-time defending Nations Cup champions and have won the continental title a record 9 times. South Africa won 7-0 away against Mozambique. Algeria thrashed Sudan 14-0. Ivory Coast won 9-0 in Niger. And Kenya had an 8-0 victory over South Sudan, who are competing in the qualifiers for the first time. Also winning the first leg were Cameroon, Namibia, Senegal, Tunisia, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. Meanwhile, DR Congo were eliminated after failing to show up for a match in Equatorial Guinea. The Congolese did not turn up for their first leg of their first round tie in Malabo on Wednesday, citing logistical and financial problems. The Equatorial Guinea Federation had said it planned to honor the return fixture in Kinshasa despite the first leg not being played. But CAF has cancelled the second leg and expelled DR Congo from the competition in accordance with tournament regulations. The second legs take place this week. The aggregate winners of the 22 first-round ties will reach the second round of qualifying, which will then decide the 11 nations joining hosts Morocco at next year's final. The final is to be held from July 2nd to July 23rd. And the Nations Cup semifinalists will qualify for the 2023 Women's World Cup, which will be held in Australia and New Zealand. Nominations have been announced for World Athlete of the Year 2021. Among the nominees are three Africans: Kenya's Faith Kipyegon and Eliud Kipchoge, and Uganda's Joshua Cheptegei. Kipyegon won the Olympics 1500 meters title in August, becoming only the third woman to retain her title after becoming a mother in between games. The 27-year-old was one of the 10 female nominees named by World Athletics on Wednesday. On Thursday, the 10 male nominees were revealed, with Cheptegei named after a year in which he became the 5,000 meters Olympic champion and also won 10,000 meters silver in Tokyo. Already a two-time World Athlete of the Year, 36-year-old Kipchoge won the men's marathon title at the Olympics. Not only does he hold the world record, but the two-time Olympic gold medalist is also the only man to have run the distance in under 2 hours in assisted conditions in 2019. The male and female World Athletes of the Year will be announced in December. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace.
Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The Greek philosopher Socrates, reputed to be the wisest man ever lived, once proclaimed, and I quote, "An unexamined life is not worth living." Later, another philosopher, this time a Spanish philosopher, George Santayana, stated that those who ignore the history are condemned to repeat it. In this connection, Africans should take note that last week marked the 10th anniversary of the killing of Gaddafi, the longtime ruler of Libya, and a close supporter of the African Union towards the end of his life. Then followed the downfall of the Arab Jamahiriya. Instead of ending the civil strife in Libya, Libya descended into utter chaos. And we are today witnessing the results of that downfall, and after 10 years, there is still no end in sight for these concerns and welfare of the Libyan people. Initially also, Africans from south of the Sahara were the immediate victim. Libyans who felt that black Africans have been supported by Gaddafi were met with strong opposition, many were killed, and they too had to flee. But that was not all. Armed groups all over Libya began to pour down south beyond the Sahara. They were full of weapons, well-trained armed groups, and the first victim was Mali. The ancient cities in Mali were demolished. And then we noticed also that over the last 10 years, these groups, which initially came from Libya, have now spread throughout the Sahel. They are now all over Central Africa and even perhaps in East Africa. The question for many Africans is, how did we come to this position? How could a country which has been very calm, even though some might say beyond the calmness was turmoil? Well, it all began in Tunisia. A lonely young man protested and committed suicide to protest what he felt was going wrong in Tunisia. The result was that the demonstration prompted the removal of the president of Tunisia, and he fled the country. At this stage, there emerged a slogan, so-called Arab Spring. And those who coined it believed that the time had come to sweep away all the authoritarian leaders in the Arab world, and a new dawn will arrive with democracy flourishing and the people very, very, very happy. Of course, this did not happen, even though there were tempting tumults in Egypt and in Syria. But these developments encouraged those who have long sought the removal of Colonel Gaddafi, even though he had appeased them when he agreed to dismantle what was an infant nuclear industry. And they decided that it was time for the world community to protect the people in eastern Libya that had arisen against Gaddafi. Of course, eastern Libya is populated by Libyans who never forgave Gaddafi for the overthrow of King Idris, because King Idris came from their region. And there was a time when it was felt that Gaddafi was determined to move against the East, and it may result in slaughter. The African Union, to its credit, came out with a roadmap which sought to promote peaceful change and settlements among the Libyans. But those who believed the time was right to remove Gaddafi for all time set out on the diplomatic move, first of all, to squash the roadmap of the African Union. The next stage was to go to the Gulf Cooperation Council and promote the idea of a United Nations intervention instead of an African Union intervention. The Gulf Cooperation Council proposed a no-fly zone, and this was sent down to the League of Arab States to urge the Council of the UN to authorize it. Rather now, you see two plans, one from the African Union and the other from the League of Arab States. Obviously, that from the League of Arab States prevailed because those promoting it knew this might end in the removal of Gaddafi, and so it was. And that led to the death of Gaddafi. But then one will ask, how was this done in the secure of the Council? And here there's a lesson for the African continent. The resolution 1973, which authorized the no-fly zone, actually could only pass because of the votes of three African states in the secure of the Council. It was largely a NATO draft resolution. They could guarantee 7 votes, but not the required 9 votes for passage. And 3 African states in the Council, Nigeria, South Africa, and Gabon, came in to the rescue. Significantly, even some NATO members had doubts about it. And Germany, then a member of the Council, abstained. India, a stalwart of non-alignment, and the friend of Africa, also abstained. And Brazil, and a different government than now, also abstained, along with China and Russia. But Africans should know that without the 3 African votes, there would have been no fly zone resolution. So this is a lesson for African diplomacy at a time when we are seeing Africans really not at the table in major developments, not only in the continent, but around the world. Just last week, we saw turmoil again in Khartoum and growing fears that the transitional government will break. But who are those who are going to solve the problem? 2 envoys, one flown from UK, another from the United States. Where are the African intervention? Let us hope that the incident of Libya and its warning may be a lesson to the Africans. This is a time for an agonizing reappraisal of African diplomacy to ensure that the survival of Africa will not be in the hands of outsiders, but from those who have been mandated by the people to lead them. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Digress. My girl, you told me that I'm not to your love interest. See, my girl, the last time that I checked, see, nothing ain't changed yet. Except that I got a big bag and a big flag. Don't make nobody tell me nonsense, my nigga. Streets is so cold, my nigga. May nobody come try cry me a river. I'm a pull through like the strings on my guitar. Nonsense, my nigga. The streets is so cold, my nigga. May nobody come try cry me a river. I'm a pull through like the strings on my guitar.
So cold outside, my brother. I don't want pull no trigger. I just want you, what's I going place? I don't want no wahala. It's so cold outside, my brother. I don't need no brother. Me, I just want you, what's I going place? I don't want no wahala. Oh, it's so cold outside. Me, I know they let nothing to worry me. I know they let nothing to bother me. Me no owe no one apology. Me no say she don't know they bother nobody. Me, I know they let nothing to bother me. I know they let nothing to bother me. Me no owe no one apology. You get me? Me nobody tell me nonsense, my nigga.
come my maker. May nobody come try cry me a river. I'm a fool too, like the strings in my guitar. Nonsense, my nigga. If you see so come my nigga. May nobody come try cry me a river. I'm a fool too, like the strings in my guitar.
So cool outside, my brother. I don't want pull no trigger. I just want to hear, cause I'm going to. I know they let nothing to worry me. I know they let nothing to bother me. They no honor one apology. They no say she don't know they bother nobody. Me, I know they let nothing to bother me. I know they let nothing to bother me. They no honor one apology. Do you get me? It's so cold outside.
Pakulia kumbwi nimefundwa wake maexi ndo wanaumia walisema nimevunda sasa jikoni ndo linanukia yendo wangu kiti tena achoki nikimkalia tena siku zinanenepa nana wiri yamenoga mapenzi na yamesha miri anipa vinono na vikubwa ananileta chumbani nikoleza wangu wani tunacheza kibaba mama kibaba mama wakienda vitani sisi tuko nyumbani anitichi nama inama inama inama
was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Bill Iger, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, quality beats do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.